Good evening and welcome behind the news for June 14, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Mostly politics tonight. We will be speaking in a few minutes with Joel Covell about his new book, Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine, an exercise not only in political analysis, but political psychoanalysis, I think. Looking forward to that. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Christian Parenti, who will be joining us in the studio to talk about his, I believe it's his fourth visit to Afghanistan. He's back just a couple of weeks ago and in the middle of working on a book on that country, which is very, very troubled, very full of conflict, but kind of fallen out of the front pages here in the United States. And, oh yes, today is Flag Day. Are you celebrating appropriately? And let's see. Just a few words of economic commentary before we get to Joel Covell. I was having an exchange recently with a highly confident but seriously underinformed acquaintance who had some strong opinions about China. China, he claimed, was forced by the West, meaning mainly the U.S., to go capitalist. There's little but poverty in that country, and all its economic growth comes from slave labor producing cheap goods for sale abroad. The reason that China is about to surpass the U.S. as the world's leading emitter of greenhouse gases is, you guessed it, because they're serving us. Though there's a shred of truth to this, there's not much more than a shred. Chinese economic reform, shedding Maoist central planning for a kind of state-directed capitalism, was entirely homegrown. No one has forced China to do anything. The Chinese government, meaning mainly the Chinese Communist Party, was in control of the process at the beginning. It's been losing some control in recent years as economic power disperses into a new class of business people and local officials who are in on the business action. But neither the U.S. government nor the IMF had much to do with any of it. In fact, we now see our Treasury Secretary urging the Chinese to reform their economic policies in ways pleasing to Washington, and the Chinese basically flip in the bird. The process of reform has done many contradictory things. It's raised average income sharply, at the same time it's vastly widened gaps between rich and poor and between city and country. It's produced a huge industrial proletariat along with a new class of capitalists and techies. It's created an industrial infrastructure that produces mountains of cheap manufactured goods with highly exploited, low-skilled, and low-paid workers. And it's also produced industries like electronics that are quickly moving up what business pundits call the value chain, up to more expensive, more sophisticated things of increasingly local Chinese design. Much of China's spectacular growth has been funded by foreign investment, but much of it has also been funded by domestic savings. Chinese households save almost a third of their income, and those savings are channeled into new factories and infrastructure at a rate unprecedented in economic history. The country invests about 40% of its GDP. That's well over twice the share of the U.S. It's created pollution and poverty reminiscent of 19th century Britain and a world-transformingly dynamic economy with few historical precedents. In other words, all the familiar contradictions of capitalism on a stunning scale. And yes, much of what China produces is for export, and a lot of that comes here. But exports have accounted for only a third of China's recent growth rates. There is also a lot of domestically driven demand going on. And purchases from China account for only 13% of total U.S. imports and only about 2% of our total GDP, GDP being the total value of goods and services produced in this country. So 98% of what we consume here is not of Chinese origin. If, as my confident but underinformed interlocutor claimed, the U.S. wants China to be nothing more than a slave labor industrial plantation, then you have to wonder why the World Bank and IMF repeatedly urged the country to shift away from its export orientation and concentrate more on narrowing the income gaps in the country and on stimulating domestic demand. That's not the sort of advice these institutions are known for, but the Chinese case is rather exceptional. China's huge trade surplus and accumulation of over $1 trillion in foreign exchange reserves is a sign of massive global economic imbalances that threaten the whole system's stability. Yesterday, several senators introduced a bill that aims to pressure China to raise the value of its currency, which would have the effect of raising the price of its exports on world markets and presumably, therefore, reduce demand for Chinese goods. It's a dangerous gamble. We need China to buy our treasury bonds so we can continue to buy manufactured goods from them. If China were to crash, it might take the whole world down with it. And if the U.S. were suddenly to have problems borrowing billions every day, it would take our economy down and much of the world with it as well. But this kind of weird interdependence is a long way from the simple-minded colonial model of China that seems to have some subscribers on the political left. Okay, let's take a little musical break, and we will be back with Joel Covell.
In the times I dream of Jesus, it's like he's coming through the walls. When I'm working at my desk at night, I hear his footsteps in the hall. You can't believe me, not believe me. I'm just a bird upon the sill, and these words just course right through me like water through a mill. He was a rebel Jew, he was a rebel Jew, and he died for you.
He was a rebel Jew. That was the Silver Jews from an album about 12 years old. And, of course, he was talking in a typically ironic indie rock fashion about Jesus there. But we have another kind of rebel Jew in the studio here. We've got Joel Covell, who is the author of a new book called Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine, which is just out from Pluto Press.
Greetings.
Welcome, Joel. So, first of all... your background. You are a Brooklyn Jew by
Brooklyn
origin.
Jew,
right?
Yes. The mainspring of the diaspora, and also from the southern Russia, Ukraine part of it, means Ashkenazi Jew. Ashkenazi Jew being a European or Eastern Central European Jew, as against the Arabic or Oriental Jews. And State of Israel is an Ashkenazi Jewish project, has to be kept in mind. And it has many internal complications along that dimension. But that's my kind of Jewry, and I was raised in a very conventional, conservative Jewish family.
Religious at all?
No, well, conflictedly so. My parents were very divided on this as in everything else. And my mother was much more conventionally religious. My father... I don't know what his religion was, but it wasn't conventional Judaism. He was a strange man and politically right-wing, as a matter of fact, and hated Zionism. Because my mother loved Zionism, and that was a big issue in the family, which enabled me to develop, I think, a very early critical distance from the phenomenon because I could see that it was contested, you know, and... It wasn't a simple matter of loyalties.
Well, what you say brings up an issue that strikes many of us goyim as strange. Jewishness, is it a nationality? Is it a culture? Is it a religion? It's kind of uncanny. Uncanny its unclassifiability.
Yes, it's really hard to classify. It's certainly not a nationality. I mean, the Zionist project attempts to turn it into a nationality with disastrous results and... it just doesn't work at all. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the Jews were people of a certain biblical identity who were scattered around the planet and developed...
And as you pointed out, people who really cherish their apartness.
That's from, apartness and also universality. Being apart gave you a perspective on the bigger picture. You weren't tied into a parochial interest. You had the sense of, you know, being... part of the whole, so to speak.
What Comrade Stalin was later to call the rootless cosmopolitan.
The rootless cosmopolitan. Well, not so bad, actually. I mean, it's I can get
there's a lot
that.
To be said for that. Yes,
I like that. I think it's one of the glories of being Jewish is not to be tied down tribally. On the other hand, you have a dialectic within Judaism between tribalism and universality. And... those are two possibilities of the notion of a people apart, which is a notion that's inscribed in the early books of the Bible and actually anthropologically, archaeologically is recognized as the fact that the Israelites, before they were called Jews, this is way back 1,500 years before the Common Era, were distinguished from other tribes in that they did not share their rituals. There was a tremendous commerce, in, so to speak, informal commerce and rituals, people sharing gods, ways of looking at the universe. But there was this tribe that did have a certain stiff-backed and sense of being different and separate.
And is that when the chosen people thing came about?
The chosen people thing certainly came about as a vicissitude of that, yes. I mean, and it came out to the notion of a covenant, so that this, you know, what is God is a projection of the human at a certain point in history. That was Feuerbach's and later Marx's insight, but it certainly is more than a grain of truth to it. I mean, we make our gods according to as to who we are. And we're perfected or divine visions of ourselves, so to speak. And if a people is, you know, feel separate and other, then the God will recognize that. And the God will say, your separateness is a blessing upon you. But it also is an obligation. It is a sense of almost a burden. And Judaism became the first guilt culture, so to speak, the first time in which human history in which sort of an internalized sense of conscience, which again was the internal voice of that God, told the people to do this, do that, and punish them for straying. So you had this very complex moral foundation to the Jewish way of being, which I'm only barely suggesting out here because it's played out over many centuries and in many concrete settings, you know. But it could be abstractly analyzed as between the tribalized covenantal relationship with God, where we're different from and sort of more ethical than, higher than other people because of that special relationship to the deity. And on the other hand, the notion of a way of life and a kind of social relationship that was predicated on not really belonging to any particular place and therefore having a vantage point on the whole. And in the Bible, the latter tendency was played out in the great prophetic books, you know, the prophets and prophetic traditions in the Old Testament, which were many centuries later than these early, you know, Mosaic roots of the faith, were really the foundations of a great deal of what we value in our lives, you know, namely the sense of a sense of criticism of a society. I mean, you know, in the name of a higher law, in the name of that, there's, you know, the society is abandoning its ways, and so the prophet stood outside the city state, and you know, hurled imprecations at the people who were now Israelites, Hebrews, Jewish people for betraying their own faith. And I think you can see resonances of that today because the predicament of Jews in America, the Jews under the Zionist influence and so forth, is rather similar to the imperial form of Judaism that you saw in the first temple and then again in the second temple. And we're seeing, I think, also the return of a certain prophetic challenge to that, saying that the Jewish people have sinned, they've erred, they have whored after false gods, and they're heading down a bad path. So all these things are constantly played out in this peculiar, you know, internal dynamics of that most unusual nation state at the eastern end of the Mediterranean we call Israel.
Yeah, you also early in the book quote Psalm 137, which has a very famous beginning
right.
by the rivers of Babylon, but the ending quite often forgotten
about always
smashing their little ones against right. the rocks. How does that figure in it?
Isn't that hideous?
Yeah, I quote that to people. It's one of the strange. I like quoting that because it's such a strange. Foundational text for a religion and a culture, but how does that figure in the psychology of Judaism?
It figures
and
in this. What figures is of course the splitting, the fact that the two sections of this very famous psalm, the first of which is a kind of an anthem of Zionism, because it means to go back to Jerusalem to reclaim your past, and you know to. And where the weeping Jew who longs for union with his or her homeland and so on. And that's split off from the last verse of the psalm, which is all there in the Bible. You know, it's right there, Book of Psalms, which said, remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem's fall, how they said, tear it down, down to its foundations, O daughter of Babylon, you devastator. Happy shall they be who pay you back what you have done to us. Happy shall they be who take your little ones and dash them against the rock. Now, that's really...
Infanticide is not usually the stuff of inspirational literature.
But also infanticide as a mode of revenge. And the fact that that's split off from contemporary Jewish awareness certainly doesn't mean it's not there. Anybody who understands, you know, depth psychology knows that that which is split off is not lost, but it's sometimes enacted. It's just not reclaimed. It's not appropriated. You know, it's not part of ourselves. And in this case, I mean, there is a thread throughout human history of revenge, you know, of violence that is visited upon you and then you pay back, or you identify with the aggressor and you pay it back to another victim. And from that standpoint, the whole history of Zionism is a kind of a part of the vengeance cycle, which, you know, is certainly not unique to that part of the world. I mean, you can read about it, probably its greatest literary rendition occurs in Aeschylus in the Oresteia, you know, the cycle of the killings of the, you know, the father kills the daughter, the mother kills the father, the son kills the mother, and then finally he is released by his ascension to a higher level of civilization in the third play of that trilogy. That dynamic of revengefulness, of course, plays out over and over again, and you know, for instance, not trivially in our debates over capital punishment, for instance. You know, you kill somebody and then you must be avenged. The family must have its vengeance. And the state becomes the instrument of that vengeance. Well, Zionism is very definitely a product of that because the Jews are burning with hatred for having been excluded, and not all Jews, but I mean the Jews who became Zionists. The Zionism was a pathway out of that sense of injury, the sense of being slighted, of being denied the liberal professions and so on and so forth. And then, of course, reached its, you know, its fever pitch with the Second World War and the monstrous genocides of the Nazis against the Jews.
Yeah,
and
that
the whole vengeance cycle becomes really built into the whole state of Israel, and is hardly ever acknowledged.
I do want to return to that theme in a little bit, but yeah. Zionism arose in the 19th century in Europe, surrounded by a lot of other romantic nationalisms at the time. So, but this was a nationalism that had no tie to a particular physical territory.
A big difference. Humongous difference.
Think about that. Think aloud about that for a little while.
Yes, I mean, people don't really ponder that. They say, well, you know, Jewish people deserve their state. But, you know, a nation state is predicated on the nation part. And the Jewish people did not have a nation in that very real sense of an organic, sustained relationship to a land, which could have been conquered, overrun by others, you know, I mean, Irish, for instance, you know, or could have itself been a conquering nation, but nonetheless, you know, went through ups and downs, you know, all the nations of Europe. And all these nations were predicated in part upon cleansing out other kinds of evil. Almost every European nation state.
Lots of population transfer.
Lots of population transfer in the history of, but the population transfers were grounded in the fact that there was an identifiable people who claimed the organic relationships to a certain piece of territory. And in the case of Zionism, that relationship was posited, but not as a reality, however, as a fantasy grounded upon the only thing that they did have in common, which was their biblical origins, because they had been dispersed since the first century, really, of the Common Era. So the common link through all this, if you're going to, you know, recapture the nation, you have to do it from at its point of biblical origin. So, and that meant, in effect, that dialectic between the tribal and the universal would be rapidly and radically skewed towards the tribal part, because that was the only way in which the Jewish people could reclaim their identity. And that the actual history of the nation would be enacted in its creation as a, you know, the sovereign over a real piece of territory. And this has led the Zionist project to be imbued with a kind of fierce desire, which is, however, set about by tremendous terrors and senses of guilt. So it's a very fraught relationship from the very beginning. The nationality has to be built in the conquest. It's not pre-given by an organic relationship to territory.
That's the voice of Joel Covell, yeah, who is the author of Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine, just published by Pluto. And you point out that Israel has the rare distinction of having had three heads of state who, yes, are actual professional terrorists.
Yes.
And by any formal definition, they qualify eminently, although it might not please Marty Peretz or Abe Foxman. But,
well, that's too bad. I go back and check the history.
But,
and the dictionary, by the way.
you've talked a little bit about this already, but you write about this in the book.
Yeah.
The cycle of bad conscience.
Yes, that's very important.
And revenge. So
phenomenal.
Psychoanalyze,
yes,
the Israeli mind for us.
Well, of course, it's more than a mere subjective psychoanalysis. It's grounded in the way in which this history is enfolded into the living psyche of the collectivity. The three terrorists cum heads of state are Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Shamir, and Ariel Sharon, each of whom has really lurid acts of terrorism attached. We take us too much time to go into that, but it is the case. And of course, it casts into considerable doubt the constant ranting about the alleged, inherent terrorism, almost genetically endowed terrorism of the Palestinians, when you have this actual enshrinement of terror in the highest levels of the Israeli state.
Another, and in the living memories of many Israelis.
Oh, absolutely. And it's all laid out. I mean, there's no doubt about it, particularly now with the new histories, particularly by a man named Ilan Pape, who was paid tremendously for this, has been basically expelled from Israel and has had to move to England, and is a very brave man. He's shown how the actual founding of the State of Israel in 1948, forget the 67 occupation, that's a terrible, terrible thing, but the more significant event was in 48, when the founding of the State of Israel occurred through a very conscious and deliberate, carefully thought out strategy of ethnic cleansing.
And interesting, one of the historians who's chronicled that, Benny Morris, has actually come around to endorse it.
Yes. I have a lengthy passage about him because he embodies the bad conscience part. Now, let me just dwell a little bit on this. I, as a raised Jewish, know full well that one of the deep and problematic but really very powerful elements of our identity was a sense of moral and ethical superiority. And you can still see it parlayed in the various public announcements of the various institutions of Jewish society. But we were always made to believe that we're ethically superior, and that the idea of justice arose with the Jewish people, and this has been our contribution to civilization. You can read the standard histories. They'll all basically say that kind of thing. So you have this very, very profound and necessary part of your identity. That ethical superiority is accompanied by notions that we suffered for it, that we were always persecuted, that we were always the victims of the terrible goyim who couldn't stand how wonderful we were, and the like. Well, along comes the Zionist project, where there is no national identity, and that has to be created through conquest, and conquest of a people who are living somewheres, and basically cleared out of the land. So you have a very basic impulse of ethnic cleansing built into the very foundations of the Zionist project. And that doesn't just start in 48. That goes back to the later 19th century, and you see that enacted again and again and again. It's all played, in the book, but there are many other accounts of it. So you have here as profound a contradiction as you can imagine. In other words, a singular belief in one's virtue and victimhood, and a practice that turns that 180 degrees radically on its head cannot possibly be, reconciled with it. Namely, we must get rid of these others who are there. And I say others because one of the most important phenomenon attached to that is that this is in the matrix of profound and very structural racism. Because the only way in which there can be some kind of marginal a reconciliation between the ethical self-image and the rapacious ethnically cleansing practice is by saying that we're driving out people who aren't real humans, who don't even exist, as in some versions of Zionism, who are in any case subhuman, that are much worse than us, that are congenitally terrorists, and so on and so forth. And
the drug more, roaches in a bottle.
Drug roaches, yes. And the more, but, and the more they, the more they're brutalized and vanquished and put down, the worse comes the conflicts of the bad conscience. And another side to that, of course, is the fabulous thin-skinnedness of the of the Zionist apparatus, with its bristling institutions like the, you know, Anti-Defamation League, which constantly polices the perimeter, so to speak, of the psychological state by looking for anybody who criticizes it, and then of course knocking them with the rubric of anti-Semitism, which has been extraordinarily effective, by the way.
But I do see some signs of that crumbling around the edges.
Yes, it is, and
they seem to be getting more historical in reaction
to it. The key thing is that this is not a stable, you know, there's no equilibrium possible, either in the real world basis, because the state of Israel is. I mean, you couldn't have chosen a worse place to try to put the state of Israel. You know, it was something that involved a settler colonial policy with radical expulsion of the indigenous people. But unlike that in the U.S., which is closely related, of course, with the Indians are going. The Indians could be, you know, gotten out of sight. But here, the settler colonial policy was right in the center of the Arab world, you know, with hundreds and millions of people who are just going to hate you to eternity. So there is never going to be any actual external peace, and nor is there ever going to be any internal reconciliation. That is a country that is as doomed as that word doom can.
But in some perverse sense, it seems that Israel thrives on that state of permanent war.
It thrives on it, but look at the trajectory. I mean, the country is in such a state of moral disintegration at this point. You know, they don't really believe in it anymore. The heroic past is gone.
We don't hear much about that over here.
No, but it's very real.
Israelis are talking about it.
Very real. You know, they're a lot of very sensitive, intelligent people, and they're saying, we have dug ourselves into this trap. And nobody's to say how we can get it out. What I try to do in this book is argue that there is necessary to devise at least a lodestar, some kind of guiding principle that will point the way out of this nightmarish situation.
Yeah, we have 2 minutes left with the two-minute tyranny here, the final two-minute tyranny. But your subtitle, Single Democratic State, you're not for a two-state solution. You're
definitely
for a one-state solution, secular, and you even say socialist.
There seems to be
next to no constituency for that right now.
Who
is the potential constituency for this?
No constituency in terms of any above ground political formations. A considerable constituency if you scratch beneath the surface. People, after they talk about it, will say, yeah, that's kind of really what I had in mind, you know. And Palestinians now who are not allowed to talk about that because their political representatives in Hamas and Fatah so are battling for the two-state. If you talk—
Well, they're battling each other now,
battling
too.
Battling each other now, which is, of course, fomented by Israel and the United States. And the politics on the ground is never-endingly awful. But there is this thin hope, which is grounded in the realization of humanity, basically, the fundamentals of human rights, which people around the world are not insensitive to, in my view. And I think that this is the idea whose time must come. The two-state solution is totally bankrupt. All it does is it gets you to the level of apartheid South Africa, because right now Israel is below that level, and that's not going to settle anything. As long as you have that Jewish state, the Zionist state, that is going to keep reproducing these terrible contradictions. And all of this, of course, is played out in global geopolitics with the, you know, horrifically complex relationship to the U.S. and, you know, the oil situation. So we know how troubled those waters are. But I think it's essential to say there is a path that you must look towards, because that helps organize the practices that you engage in.
And it's very essential to say that in the United States, where it's not often said, but where the checks are written and the weapons are made. I've been speaking with Joel Covell, who is the author of Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. Much, much rich material in here that urge everyone to go out and get a copy. Just published by Pluto Press. And we'll be back in station break, and then we'll be back in a little bit to talk with Christian Parenti. We'll be right back.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WVAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York. Enjoy.
And this is WBAI. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. Let's take a little musical break, and then we'll talk to Christian. Murder funded by your tax dollar. That is Erase Errata, a band from San Francisco from an album that came out last year. And we certainly have a lot of murder funded by our tax dollar here in the United States, don't we?
Sure do.
We're now joined in the studio by Christian Parenti, a prolific author, journalist, a great foreign correspondent of our time. Welcome, Christian.
Thank you very much.
And I do want to talk to you about Afghanistan, which you were recently visiting, but... Iraq, man, things look like they're going from bad to worse to worser.
Yeah.
We have the Times reporting the other day that the U.S. is now funding Sunnis, militias to fight al-Qaeda, and the same Sunnis who had been fighting U.S. troops not all that long ago and maybe still be doing so.
Yeah.
And then we have the attack on the shrine yesterday.
The final demolition of the shrine in Sumara.
It looks really bad.
Yeah, it's like the end of the world. And in Iraq, in central Iraq, the world is ending, you know. If you lived here, that's what would be happening for you. So, I mean, I don't know what to say, man. It's, it seems to be what it appears to be. The whole public discourse around it, the Bush administration's discourse, which leads the way for the mainstream press, though they're more critical, is in total denial of the fact that everything has failed from the U.S.
Well, they keep keeping hope alive that the surge may be working.
Right, which it hasn't. I mean, one of the main functions of the surge was to go after Sadr, who followed classic guerrilla warfare techniques and just disappeared and laid low. And, you know, things have gotten only worse and worse. The bombing of all the bridges connecting the east and west sides of Baghdad and really the southern approaches too, because the river curves in that way. That's also, you know, really horrible development. So it's awful. And, I mean, the U.S. has to leave. It will leave. And I've been saying this for a while. I don't think that when the U.S. leaves, everything is going to be fine. I don't subscribe to that position at all. But I just think that the reality is that the U.S. faces, just objectively, materially, has been defeated. Its project, its economic project, its military project has been defeated. And there is now an out-of-control, self-propelling, multi-sided civil war going on in Iraq that the U.S. is stoking and simultaneously trying to play umpire to. And it seems to me they have no real clear strategy, that it's just sort of political season by political season patchwork of tactics trying to pass as a strategy. And
well,
the base point
like
is that Bush has been very clear from the beginning that he's not leaving. So it's like, you know, I'll just hold on until the next guy comes in, because he's not going to leave. So whatever.
Well, his father's associate, Georgianne Geyer, had a column a couple of weeks ago saying that W was at the Memorial Day picnic down in Texas, pounding his chest saying, "I'm the president. I'm the president." And he was going to make sure that his successor had no choice but to pursue America's destiny in Iraq. So,
Wow, I hadn't seen that.
It's really remarkable.
Yeah, there is
completely demented, but has considerable state power at his disposal.
You know, and we always—I always feel—I guess—feel the need to bring up these themes on your show. But sort of like, what is a kind of a Marxist influenced analysis? How does it work? And you know, typically we would privilege structure in our analysis of how history moves, but there are moments when personalities are key. You know, and I think we're in one of them where a lot of what's happened in Iraq is not about the structural needs of American imperialism. Projecting power into the region that controls most of the world's oil, yes, that's sort of structurally imperative to U.S. empire building. But invading Iraq, doing it this way, managing the occupation this way, none of that was determined by any kind of structural set of interests. Those were political choices made by a specific group of people who increasingly seem kind of like they're out of their minds.
Yeah, your typical Marxist analysis does not have much room for the insanity of the people in power, but it seems to explain at least part of what's going on.
Yeah,
because it makes no sense otherwise. But now they're facing a massive defeat, which could very seriously damage the reputation of the empire around the world and seriously damage American power. The American military has been stretched thin and
yes and no. I mean, there's ways in which it won't, you know, because like let's say the U.S. gets defeated in Iraq. The main problem is that the crisis in Iraq spills over, as it already sort of is, into other regions, as you have vets from the jihad moving back to Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon and then receiving money there from the U.S. as well, as Seymour Hersh has shown. And now, you know, you've got renewed war in Lebanon against these hardcore Sunni militias in the refugee camps.
But the U.S. seems to be promoting sectoral conflict, religious and ethnic conflict across the whole region, which seems like
a
bomb could blow up in your face.
Right. One analysis is that the U.S. wants to rule through chaos. I don't think that the U.S. actually wants to rule through this level of chaos. I think it's more that in this administration, there really is no kind of strategic planning. There's sort of strategic ideas and visions, and then there's just a series of tactics of, you know, the crisis that the war has tipped too far in the favor of the Sunnis. Well, throw some money too far in the favor of the Shia, who now have power in Iraq. We'll throw some money back at the Sunni fundamentalists, who were the forces that the U.S. traditionally funded to counterbalance the left throughout the Middle East. So it's just back and forth. And then, oh, surprise, surprise, that turns into civil war in Lebanon, which then, okay, well, now, you know, who do we favor in this moment of crisis? The Lebanese government. Fund money. Hopefully, maybe the Lebanese government can use this as a kind of testing ground, and they can take on Hezbollah if they can first take on these, you know, factionalized, crazy jihadist militias in the camps. So then pump money into the Lebanese army. I mean, it just seems to me like an ad hoc strategy.
Yeah, they seem to get into one crisis and then invent, come up with something that's only going to produce the next crisis down the road. But it seems to be the expedient way out at the moment.
Yeah.
We can also talk about perhaps joining conflicts past, present, and future, because now the Bush administration is saying that Iran is arming the Taliban. First of all, do you think there's anything to it?
You know, I really have no idea. I mean, I think that the administration is saying that for political reasons, but I have no idea whether they are or aren't. I know they very well could be, but there are all sorts of obvious political reasons why they wouldn't, which is that their politics and theocracy are very different. I mean, the Taliban are fundamentalist Wahhabi Sunni, and the regime in Iran is Shia. There are parties in the government of Afghanistan currently that are pretty tied to Iran. And there's also sort of material links that cross the Sunni-Shia divide between the city of Herat in the west of Afghanistan and Iran. So I think there's probably lots of complex links. And there may, in fact, be some links to the Taliban. But I doubt it. But the point being, the main foreign funding of the Taliban, if we're looking for a state that harbors the Taliban, gives them safe haven, trains them, arms them, directs them, it's Pakistan. And this is established just with a mountains of evidence. You know, Pakistan is running, essentially,
our great ally of the war on terror.
Yeah. And you know, we're not about to bomb Pakistan. Pakistan already has nuclear weapons, and it's funding terrorists who kill American soldiers, who kill civilians, burn down women's schools, do horrible things, are trying to impose a completely deranged backward theocracy on southern Afghanistan. And the Pakistan actively supports this. People have proven it again and again. And the U.S. is not talking about bombing Pakistan.
Speaking with Christian Parenti, a frequent writer for The Nation, who is, you know, you're working now on a book on Afghanistan.
Yes, I'm working on a book. It should be out in about a year or so.
What did you see on your latest trip? Afghanistan has disappeared more or less from our news.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff going on there, though. The Taliban seem to be resurgent. What are they up to?
Well, I didn't travel around very much this trip. I was there actually specifically for Playboy magazine doing an in-depth investigation into the case of a close friend of mine who was murdered by the Taliban. He was an interpreter named Ajmal Naqshbandi, a fixer and interpreter. And he was kidnapped with Mastro Giacomo, the Italian journalist, about 2 months ago. So that's a lot of what I was doing, was investigating that case. And so I did not go into risky areas. I'm also not trying not to do that much anymore. But basically, the news is that, you know, on the southern side of Kabul, the villages just outside of town are, you know, maybe Taliban-controlled would be too strong a word, but the Taliban operate in them, and pro-government, you know, people who have jobs working for the government can't live in those villages. They can visit their families on the weekends, but they have to leave. So the Taliban is in control of the southern half of the country. They've been working on cutting.
And this is just outside the capital.
This is like 20 minutes outside of Kabul. This is like.
So Karzai, the joke that he's the mayor of Kabul is pretty much true.
It's pretty much true, yeah. In the south, they run the countryside completely. And also in the east, in Nangarhar province, so it's sort of like in a crescent that's the southern half of Afghanistan and then sweeps up past Kabul along the eastern, northeastern edge of Afghanistan with the border of Pakistan, and then up in Kunar and Nuristan on the Pakistani border. That's where you have Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, which specifically in that context means a network of Arab and foreign fighters who are mostly veterans of the anti-Soviet jihad who operate up there, not really down south, but up there. Have they been there all along? They've been there.
Since the U.S. invasion?
Since the U.S. invasion. When Osama bin Laden was kicked out of Sudan in whatever it was, 96, I think, but he went back to Afghanistan, which was then controlled mostly by the Taliban. And during the course of the Taliban's rule, Al-Qaeda, being a sort of, you know, loose network of people around Osama bin Laden and his organization, Al-Qaeda, which was, you know, set up during the U.S.-funded jihad as a support group for the kind of internationalists who were fighting the Soviets, insinuated himself into the Taliban cabinet even. So they've always been there. When the Taliban regime fell, they melted away. And the Taliban are linked with Al-Qaeda in some sort of, you know, tacit alliance. There's an advisory role. It seems that the suicide bombs that are organized in Kabul have some sort of Al-Qaeda element to their planning. And then those two components are held together by at least dissident elements, or not dissident, but at least former elements of the Pakistani intelligence services, the inter-services, inter-intelligence services, ISI.
So when you say Pakistan, it's not Musharraf who's pulling their strings. It's some forces within the Pakistani state.
Yeah.
That may not be dominant, but they're...
But they're important parts of a very important class within Pakistan. And Pakistan, in its 50-year history as a nation, its officer class has always played an important role in, you know, running the country. There's been three military dictatorships. The officer class, like in many third world countries, is like not just a professional group, but sort of a class that really holds power in the society, even when they're not in political power. And so that's the class from which this idea of weakening Afghanistan comes. And it has a lot, you know, it's an old fight that's been going on. It has to do with the fact that the British created a boundary between what was then British India and Afghanistan in 1893 called the Durand Line. And in that, Afghanistan lost huge amounts of territory, including its winter capital, which is now Peshawar, Pakistan. So it might not seem very important to the average American, but if you're a middle class or wealthy Afghan living in Kabul or some provincial city, it does actually matter that you lost your winter capital to the Pakistanis. And I mean, Afghanistan was never a functioning modern nation state, but it declared itself and began forming itself into a state in 1749 and had basically, you know, the same boundaries from that time on until the Durand Line sliced off a bunch of their territory. So there's been this fight, this irredentist fight over recapturing a lot of these lands. And what the Durand Line did was it divided the areas of the Pashtun population, which are the dominant ethnic group in Afghanistan. They're the majority minority, and they're a minority, a restive, poor, borderland minority within Pakistan. So Pakistan uses the Pashtun tribesmen to foment trouble in Afghanistan. And this has been happening in the form of guerrilla warfare since the early 70s. So before the communist coup, before the Soviet invasion, Pakistan was funding some of the same people who are at arms now to fight against the Afghan government. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who runs Hezbollah Islami, which is referred to usually in the news as just Taliban, but they're not actually the Taliban. They're the insurgent group that actually controls the areas right around Kabul and in the east.
Is he the dude who throws acid at the faces of unveiled women?
Mm-hmm. He got his start doing that at the University of Kabul in the 60s, where the Afghan communists as students and the Afghan Islamists who then lead the Mujahideen sort of first locked horns during the ferment of the 1960s, and they then become, you know, the leaders of the Afghan Communist Party and of the which has actually two wings that fight each other bitterly, and of the Mujahideen. So yeah, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar during the jihad received the bulk of American funding, and he is now, but he first got his start fighting Daoud, who was a kind of nationalist, you know, developmentalist prime minister or president, and funded by Pakistan, and now he's at it again.
So are the Taliban that we're talking about, the Taliban, the literal Taliban, the actual Taliban, the same people that crossed into Afghanistan from the schools of Pakistan? Is it the same? Are they attracting new recruits?
Oh, yeah, they're attracting new recruits. I mean, a lot of their soldiers are teenagers who, you know, in other words, people who were like were only born in their early 90s, some of them. But yeah, some of their leaders are people who have been with that movement all the way through. And
they're not getting a bad rap. They really are as reactionary theocrats, as everyone says.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they really are. They are. And there's an ethnic element to the whole thing. They have a level of consent among the Pashtun population or elements of the Pashtun population in the south, because the government in Kabul, though Karzai is a Pashtun and all presidents or kings of Afghanistan have always been Pashtun, but the government is seen as being dominated by the Tajiks and Uzbeks and Hazaras who make up the Northern Alliance, the other ethnic groups. And so the Pashtun feel aggrieved about that. And the culture of rural, particularly southern Afghanistan, is very, very conservative, you know, and the country is extremely underdeveloped. It has a sort of feudal political economy. There are very few paved roads.
Life expectancy was 45 years the last time they're collecting statistics.
It ranks third from the bottom on the UN Human Development Index, one of the poorest countries in the world. There are 28 million people there, incredibly mountainous, very deserty. I mean, it's an incredibly hard place to live. And so,
suffering decades of warfare.
Yeah. And so in the isolated rural south, the society there is extremely conservative. And so the Taliban come along and they are claiming to fight the corruption of the Karzai government. And originally, that was one of the few things they had going for them, is that they were not corrupt. And they tend to, so far, I think, not be so corrupt. They're not about shaking everybody down for money. They're about pursuing their jihad against the foreigners. And that involves horrible intimidation and pushing locals around, but it doesn't involve the kind of, you know, just sleazy, everyday, quotidian ripoffs that the government officials perpetrate against the population. So there is a kind of element of consent among some people in the South for the Taliban. But yes, in answer to your question, yeah, they are really bad.
I'm speaking with Christian Parenti, a frequent contributor to The Nation magazine, who is just in Afghanistan and is writing a book on that country. So we have NATO very active there, and the United States, of course, lots of troops there. What is the U.S. and NATO up to?
Well, I mean, my whole analysis of Afghanistan is that it was a stepping stone to Iraq. So that conditions everything that NATO is up to. And what they're doing is they're pursuing a classic guerrilla war, a counterinsurgency war. You know, they're trying to find the enemy and separate them from the civilian population. And in the process of doing that, they're, you know, killing civilians and humiliating and detaining.
Now, are there many successful counterinsurgency wars in history?
It seems like there aren't. I think it's very hard. I think if you're not going to basically commit genocide and flood the colony with settlers, that it's pretty hard to successfully win. I mean, there are some, but, you know.
The odds are against you.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what they do. And there's not that. I mean, there are 50,000 roughly NATO troops in Afghanistan. But the level of support to combat units is so high that there aren't that many troops in the fields, and so they're doing, you know, doing classic counterinsurgency, search and destroy, calling in airstrikes. You know, when they engage the Taliban, they usually cream them. But that's not the nature of guerrilla warfare. So when the Taliban engage, they fall back.
When you call in airstrikes, you bomb wedding parties and such, too, and alienate the people you're supposedly trying to win over.
Yeah. And this is a society where, you know, you don't, as a man, and you would never meet somebody's wife or even their mother. You know, you simply don't meet women. That's the level of purdah, the concept of sheltering and secluding women. It reaches that level of an extreme in Afghanistan. It's like just intense village logic. So, you know, in a culture like that, then you go, even if not just bombing, but you go in the middle of the night to someone's quarters and you know, pull their wife and daughter out into the yard and zip tie their hands while the man is like searched and they go through every cupboard in the house looking for guns. That's pretty humiliating. And
that's
for a lot
the way
of
to win hearts and minds, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, time before this one, when I was here, I interviewed a guy who had been a Taliban. He was Pashtun up north, and this had happened to him. And the way it went down was the local Tajik warlord, who was the governor, Muhammad Atta, had told and gotten his agents to tell NATO that this guy, Haji Akhtar, was a Taliban. And he's not really a Taliban anymore. He's just a drug dealer, but he will be a Taliban before long. So NATO goes in, the Americans, with like, you know, a bunch of vehicles and helicopters. They surround his basically mud-walled castle. He's the man in charge of the tenant farmers in these three counties, and they all grow opium and hashish. And they do exactly what I just described, you know, drag him out in front of his wife and family. And this guy was, you know, furious about this. And then the next thing they did was they picked a fight with his son, and they killed his son. So in society, in Pashtun society in Afghanistan, a guy like that who's in charge of like three districts, who's the head man in a society where everybody carries guns, where feuds go on for generations at a time, he has no option but to pick up the gun.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but this looks like yet another defeat in the works of the United States.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what this book is going to be analyzing is the history of these types of defeats and the specifics of this one, because I suspect that that just as Afghanistan was the way into Iraq, so too will it be the way out. That Democrats, in justifying their surrender in Iraq, which someone's going to have to lose Iraq, are going to try and paper over it with claiming to, you know, really do Afghanistan right. You know, come year seven in Afghanistan, they're going to think that they can, like, get, you know, just start it all over again.
Well, that's inspiring. Hillary will lead us to victory in Afghanistan, won't she? We've been talking with Christian Parenti, who is a frequent contributor to The Nation magazine and in the early stages of writing a book on Afghanistan, a country that people have not been paying enough attention to. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I will be back next week. And let's go out with this proto-weekend dance hit from Bob Sinclar.
Comes a time in everyone's life that you need a little relaxation, you know?
Run it!
Listen to this, Julia. Listen to this.
That's how it said. Not a Bob Sinclar track, Gary Pine. For the man called Q2B and Dalamon.
Yes, man.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, oh, yeah.
What I believe.
Yeah, yeah,
everybody's free.
Got to be free now.
Feel good.
Sing.
Got to feel good about you.
Everybody's
Rastaman.
Free.
Give me some more. Tonight me coffee up front. I'm not living till the party's done.
Everybody.